When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
They're kind of showing that it's possible, this new generation, to break through to the top level. It's not like it's totally not, it's not just the older generation. Okay, not too old, but yeah, not the...
Why are you looking at me when you're saying older generation? I feel so old.
He's older than I am, so that's okay.
Oh, man, I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest one here.
Oh.
Welcome back, everybody, to another C-Squared podcast. We have a very special guest today. We are here with Grandmaster Abhimanyu Mishra. He is, you've been chasing, in fact, a lot of records throughout your very young career. Up to this point, you were the youngest expert at age 7. You were also the youngest Grandmaster in history, beating a very, very difficult record, I have to say. You've achieved that when you were only 12 years, 4 months, and 25 days. I have to say that is just simply incredible.
Thank you.
Fabi, what do you think of those records?
Well, I didn't get close to that. I was 2 years later. So it's, of course, 12 years Grandmaster is amazing. This is, what are your next goals? Now that you've become Grandmaster, you've played in the U.S. Championship, which just finished. You've even scored +2, a remarkable result. What are your next goals after this?
Yeah, my next goal is to get into top 100, which is another... My current rating is 2616. It's another, like, 25 points. Okay, after that, my main goal is to reach 2700 in another 13 months. I want to become the youngest 2700-rated player in the world.
And you would be beating out Wei Yi. Is he the current record holder?
Yes.
Okay.
What's up, guys? I just want to take a brief moment to talk to you about this video's sponsor, the Lawnmower 5.0 from Manscaped. In the strategic game of chess, we as grandmasters, we like to think a few moves ahead. The same exact principles apply to the grooming game as well. Every man knows the fear of that close shave just down below the waistline. But with the Lawnmower 5.0, I've managed to checkmate that fear. I've had the privilege to try the new Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra, and trust me, it's an absolute banger. It's a game changer. I'm always on the go. I travel a lot for my competitions, for my commentary gigs. I'm always traveling. And you know, I need that confidence to be, in terms of grooming, in tip-top shape. And the Lawnmower 5.0, it gives me that confidence. It's the perfect travel companion. It comes with a slick travel case and a travel lock feature, so I can move with absolute confidence, just like on the chessboard. You should try it out yourself. Thanks to Manscaped for sponsoring this video. You can get 20% off and free international shipping if you go to manscaped.com and use our promo code C-Squared. Now let's get back to the podcast.
That's truly impressive. But let's get it back a few notches and talk about your journey in chess. When did you start chess? Who taught you chess as well?
Yeah, at the age of 2.5, my dad introduced me to this game.
2.5?
Yeah, he introduced me to the rules. It took me, of course, like a year and a half to learn the rules and so on. But by the age of 5, I started playing normal tournaments.
Very interesting. And do you remember your first tournament?
Yeah, it was somewhere in South Jersey. I got 3 out of 4. Not 3 out of 4. 3.5 out of 4. And I think I got first place. It was a nice event.
So you won your first ever event in...
Yes.
I have a different experience from my first event. I lost all my games. It didn't go quite as well.
It was... There was a lot of planning beforehand. I used to play against this kind of computer on my iPad and so on. I remember, first of all, beating it after using like 15, 20 undos. It was the first time I beat it. I was 4 years old. And then from there, okay, I kept playing more training games, practice games. Eventually, things started to click.
So what was your training like? Like, what were your training? I assume you had as coaches as well, but what were your training practices like?
Yeah, okay, back then, I don't remember too much. It's been a while, but... Yeah, I used to play some games, do some puzzles online, but yeah, it was very like sort of casual back then.
Okay.
Casual, yeah. I mean, since I first heard your name, it has been nothing but casual, right? You were chasing records all the time, and we were hearing this in newspapers, US chess, everybody was reporting on your journey as well. When did you first start feeling like this is some sort of a projected career for you?
I guess when I broke my first record, the youngest expert in US chess history at the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I kind of loved doing the work and getting the success. The success is what propelled me to keep going. Because, okay, of course, it's very difficult to continue playing this game at a young age when if you don't have any success, it's like quite difficult to continue. So, yeah, successes keep coming. I kept working very hard and I kept seeing the results.
But there's also something else. Obviously, successes are going to be very sweet and they're going to propel you further in your journey. But you need passion as well, because at times in your chess career, you will have setbacks. It's inevitable, right? Every single player has had setbacks. How do you deal with those? And tell us a bit about your passion about chess.
Yeah, playing chess is a journey, frankly. Like every player has not mastered this game, and it's everywhere. Everyone can improve. With this game, it's either you win or you learn. This is how I try to look at it. I in the sense that either you win or, okay, if you lost the game, the thing with chess is if you've lost, you've definitely made a mistake. There's nothing like the odds were stacked against you or so on. It's like, okay, you made some mistake. You need to fix something. And every game I win, loss, draw, no matter what the result is, I analyze the game. I improve. I try to work on my problem area. So, for example, once when I was 9, I lost in some double bishop ending. And from there, I worked with my dad. I found this very nice game online. I think it was Gong Li versus Wang Hao. I spent like 6 hours on the board practicing that game. And that the next time I got a double bishop ending, I was able to play it much better.
That's also where the passion comes in, right? Because to actually look at endgames for hours and hours after you realize that you need to work on this area, it's not something that everyone can do. Like, you need a special sort of either passion or personality type to be able to apply yourself in that way. Is that something that is for you in chess or just broadly in life that you find that you have that kind of focused mentality?
I was mainly following whether, like, my father was one of my coaches in the sense that, okay, he always had great ideas, and he still does. I still follow him. The point is, okay, he had this idea that, okay, let's work on this endings, because the worst thing that can happen in chess is that you repeat the same mistake twice. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I feel nowadays that engines have become so strong and everyone has access to them, that sometimes after the game you go and you look and you see, okay, I missed this move on move 28 and I lost the game. And then you forget about it and then you move on. But the issue with this is that later on, you'll make the same mistake again. Like, not in the exact same position, but something similar to that. So I've always, whenever I make a mistake, my father, he tries to get some relevant material. My coaches, my father, we try to find some relevant material towards that, and we try to work on that.
Speaking of engines, do you feel like that's one of the ways that has helped you and also players of your generation to improve really, really quickly?
Yeah, that's definitely, it's definitely a big role. It definitely has a big role, because think about it in the times of, say, like Bobby Fischer. He had, if he messed up some game, he would have to spend hours and hours on board moving all the pieces and figuring out the conclusions all by himself. And even after that, you cannot be 100% sure. There's always some mistake or the other. Nowadays, we have, with just one, two clicks, we get like this 3,500 rated engine, which can solve basically anything.
On the other hand, it's also like, because we know that the engine is more, not infallible, but very close to it, that it can be easy to trust it without applying our own
judgment.
Yeah, our own judgment, or like thinking critically about it in the way that you brought up Bobby Fischer, players of those times, they had nothing to rely on. They would just have to rely on themselves. Do you think that also takes away a little bit from the chess learning process, or do you think it's all a positive in terms of improving at chess?
Yeah, that's a great point that, okay, engines are, that we kind of blindly trust them at times. I have a, like, there's many cases, for example, like, in chess, for example, you see like an attack that looks dangerous, but then the engine comes along and refutes it. It's of course quite disheartening. But what I think how we should work with engines is that we should try to understand what they're thinking, in the sense that okay, like if it says the end game is winning and if it's showing a clear path, then we should go with it. If things are going very far fetched and it's like a bit too much, okay, we can kind of leave it. So we should stay like within, not like human constraints, but like really like understandable.
Mm-hmm. Trying to keep the engine in rein, let's say. Trying to apply when that is relevant and when maybe human understanding is more, or practical human understanding is more important.
Yes. And I feel that's probably where coaches come in and seconds as well come in, right? Because seconds in general, they look at the position, they analyze nonstop with the engine. They don't have that leeway to try to think too much for themselves. And I think this is a point that PH, Peter Heine, made recently. What was the biggest advice or the best advice that he received from Magnus? Stop thinking.
Just, he didn't say it was Magnus. He said from a student, right?
From a student, yeah, yes. Yeah. And it was Magnus. Yeah. Just follow the engine lines, basically, which was kind of funny. But you did this, and I was doing commentary at the US Championship, and you came for an interview, and I had the engine on at one point, and he said, can you turn that off? Because I need to do training after the game. I need to look at the position with my own eyes after the games, and not have that bias inserted into the training. How are those few hours after each and every game usually progressing for you?
Yeah, it's usually quite painful. Okay, especially if you've lost a game, you go back and it's like you really just don't want to look at the board again. It's like you've messed up the game and now you have to retry it again. But
even if you don't mess up the game, you still thought for like 6 hours. Your brain is kind of burning.
Yeah,
how do you look at chess and try to actually solve problems for the next 2 hours again?
Yeah, it's mainly. Because the thing that with chess is that, okay, the same kind of problems will come again. Like, not move per move, not necessarily the same idea, the same end game, but in some sort of way, they're kind of connected. So if I made some mistake, like, for example, in my game against you, Fabi, I had some move order issues, like with bishop takes c3 and so on. That kind of helped me the next day. Like I put these positions over the board, and of course my dad had run the engine during the game, and I solved the exercises again, and that helped me the next day to find h3 against Lavon, instead of queen takes c6 directly. So these kind of things, like maybe like the positions are completely different. I agree that okay, it's not like it's what one position is very quiet, other position is completely, it's like King's Indian, all tactical. Yeah. But yeah, these kind of things are quite important.
So you're seeing patterns between even unrelated positions. For example, like keeping the tension in one position, like in our game, or releasing the tension, it might be a mistake, things like this.
Yes.
That's interesting because I feel like there are a lot of connections in chess, but we sometimes tend to only see the very direct ones and sometimes ignore that like these principles do apply in different types of positions as well.
Mm-hmm. No, that's... I really like this approach. At the same time, not everybody's built for it, I would assume. How are you doing training after the games?
Well, I wish I was as disciplined as you. I checked the engine immediately after. I can't help myself. I mean, but I'm actually very impressed that you're not checking the engine immediately after, because like the immediate desire is of curiosity, like what happened in my game. So to actually be able to stave that off for a few hours, or even for however long time it is, and try to think about the position on your own. Although I do feel like it could be very useful, because we have all these like variations we calculated, and because we've already done all this work during the game, it's quite possible to figure things out after just on your own based on all the work you did during the game, and then to see if, let's say, your conclusions are objectively correct with an engine after you've done the work. So that's very interesting as well.
Is it generally more difficult to look and do this training after a win or after a loss?
Well, it's usually more difficult after a loss, because okay, after a win, well, not always, but most of the time you've made less mistakes, so the analysis will not go on for as long. The thing is, when you've lost, it's like evaluation is dropping, position is worsening, it's more depressing to look at.
How about for you? Because I've seen you obsessively look and try to analyze and correct your mistakes, especially after a loss?
Well, after a loss, I'm obsessive. After a win, I'm like, okay, job's done. Let's chill. After a loss, I get very obsessive, and then I really like want to punish myself.
By looking at chess for like the next 4 hours. I remember that, and I keep bringing this game up against Naka.
Norway. That was
you spent the rest of the night just looking and trying to fix that thing. You didn't sleep at all. You just like looked at that position, tried to improve that particular line.
But speaking of the end of your tournament, because we had this game in the penultimate round, but then you immediately bounced back with a win against a very very strong player, one of the best players of his time for sure. Do you generally find it easy to reset after a loss, or to just like shake it off and then to move on to the next game or the next tournament or whatever it is?
Yeah, I think this is also a very important skill as a player, that no matter how bad things have gone, to be able to bounce back is kind of necessary, because like no matter how good form you're in, at some point you're bound to lose a game. Maybe in this tournament, maybe in the next tournament, but at some point you're going to lose a game. But the most important thing is that you don't collapse, because the worst thing that can happen is you lose one game, then you lose another, and then, you start tilting, and then all of a sudden the whole tournament is over, you're losing whatever you've gained, and so on. I try to go game by game that, okay, this game I've messed up, okay, I have next game. Now it's a completely new game, it has nothing to do with the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just play our best chess and hope this time it goes better.
But this must have come to you with experience, right? It probably was never that smooth. Even though if you look at your graphic, it just looks very, very smooth. But tell us a bit about your difficult moments, if you can remember some during your ascent from expert level to international master level to grandmaster level to where you are right now.
Sure. One thing with my chess journey is that I've never shied away from playing difficult tournaments. For example, when I wanted to become the youngest international master in the world, I got all my 3D norms through Grandmaster Norm events.
Mm.
And this means that, okay, at times, you're not going to have the best tournaments. Like, I think there was a period after I became international master, for 36 games, 4 full tournaments, I couldn't win a single game.
Mm.
It was very painful that, okay, you go to tournament, you lose, then you draw, then you draw a couple more games, you lose, and then you have to go back home. But I knew that, okay, this thing will not continue forever. Like, I cannot... I will start winning at some point. I kept working on my skills. I kept improving, because whenever you lose in chess, no matter whether it's time trouble or something, it's always a skill error. Skill issue.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting way to look at it, yeah.
Like, there's no such thing as...
You don't think about luck. You don't think about anything of that nature.
Okay. Like, luck you can is kind of there a little bit, but the thing is, it's mainly, like, it's... If you're missing something, it's not. You can't just say, okay, the stars are not aligned today. Right. Because if you're missing something now, you're going to miss the same thing in, like, say, 3 days. So the thing is that, okay, you have to... If you're missing something, you need to ask, why am I missing this? Like, these kind of things, like... If you miss something very simple tactically, maybe it's some kind of a blind spot that, okay, like, I think recently, like, for example, if you're not able to solve positions where, say, the king is in the center, like, there's some kind of patterns that you're kind of looking. Okay, maybe sometimes you can say it's a bad day, but usually there's some kind of patterns that are correlated.
I usually blame my unlucky pen for my losses, and then I change the pen, and then I lose again, and that's how it usually works. Are you superstitious in that regard, or it's all I take responsibility for everything type of thing?
Well, this tournament, I had a very lucky purple shirt.
So there is some superstition right there.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
A little bit.
We're getting there.
I played... I think the first game I wore it was against Ray. I won that game. Then I wore it against both of the Sams. I won both of those games too. And then I wore it against Fabi. And okay, things didn't go so well.
Maybe it's your skills and not the shirt after all.
Perhaps. Other than that, okay, like... I'm like religious. I'm with Hindu. Before every game, I do a short prayer that helps me focused during the game and so on.
Stay centered. No, I like that. I think that's definitely important. You know, we hear about elite athletes always have something that centers them, that gives them stability in this type of difficult moment. Some of them meditate before a big competition. Some of them try to clear their mind somehow. Some of them attribute successes, failures to a higher power, and that keeps them going, right? Are you religious or spiritual in that regard? Or?
Not too much, I have to say. But I do think it's very important to, to have something that doesn't let you get too ahead of yourself, let's say. To like either find perspective in life or whatever it is, or to ground yourself, as you mentioned. I think that's very important.
Well, at some point, even during the World Championship preparation against Magnus, you were doing a lot of yoga. That was one of the things that was kind of helping you ease your mind, I guess, in some way.
Yeah, that's actually, speaking of that, are you into, like, what's your, let's say, physical routine in terms of preparing for chess? Because we know it's such an important factor as well in these long tournaments, physical fitness and form.
Yeah, I'm not, like, as of now, I'm not doing too much of that. Like, usually at home, okay, sometimes I'll go for a bike ride in the afternoons, but, okay, usually it's mostly just sit in my room, start preparing, and so on.
Okay.
But still, you have that meditation, prayer, because that's a form of meditation, basically. So I think that's quite important. I like that. I like that aspect of training and centering before a round.
It's one issue. It's one area where you need to improve this physical training before the round.
I think, like, I mean, at your age, you have endless energy. Right. But when you're getting into our age territory, then you're like, okay, I need to stay fit or I'm going to burn out. But in terms of the U.S. Championship, if I'm not mistaken, this was your first top-level event. What were your emotions coming into it and during it? And after your success, how do you look back on it?
Yeah, this was one of the best events I've ever played. I think one of the similar events I've played are, like, let's say, Tepe Sigmund. I played one in Sweden. Many, like, top players nowadays were playing there. I think one was Gokesh was playing, Ved Forest, Vincent Keimer.
Yeah.
And there were, like, many other people.
That's a good event, yeah.
Another one was Dubai Open. I played against, like, Tabatabai, Salim Sela, and many other very strong players. These events I played well, and throughout these events I noticed one thing. I was always ready to fight. Like in all of these events, whatever wins I've had, they weren't just from like staying passive. It was always like fire on the board type things, and okay, then things managed to work out. Like in Tepe Sigmund, I had like two worst positions, but I managed to sit in both of them. The board was literally like I wild tactical complications and things turned out my way. So with this tournament, I was never afraid of a fight. Because, I also knew in this tournament that I was one of the lowest rated, so everyone would try to beat me. Because, okay, if one wants to win this event, you need to beat all the people in the lower half.
Somehow it always feels that there's, whenever you go from level to level to level, there's always an adjustment period when you enter a new level. And you were mentioning playing against these very strong players, 2650, 2700s. They are one level above your rating, right? So at least in your mind, even maybe objectively it's not the case, they're still considered to be stronger than you. How do you adjust to that when you have to perform against these strong players?
I guess the main thing is that, okay, nothing really changes from my side. I just have to play chess. And the pressure is kind of more on them to prove something. That, okay, they're higher rated. They have to protect the rating, sort of. And I'm just here to play a game. Okay, whatever happens, happens.
Do you remember those moments when you were climbing? Oh,
actually, one of your game against Sam Shankland reminded me of a bit of a game I played, because I used to play this French a lot myself when I was a kid, and especially the win over French. And so I often got these structures where I'm very passive and waiting, like you had you basically couldn't do anything. You just had to wait and wait and wait. And that's one of like the most difficult skills in chess, being able to just sit there knowing for the next 5 hours I'm sitting here, I have to defend this position. But then you suddenly got a chance to win the game. When did you start to feel like maybe there's a chance that maybe you're going to win this game. Maybe you won't be passive forever and it might turn around.
Yeah, actually that was quite a sad game, frankly. Like you're right. It's very difficult to just sit there and wait. Your opponent can do anything he wants. Like, his king was on, I think, like, d1. He brought the king all the way to g2 and so on. I just have to keep waiting. Queen c6, queen a4, queen c6, queen a4. I think when he started opening the position, when he was actually trying to win the game with g5 and so on, the thing is, okay, if you want to win this kind of position, you have to give some chances to black. Like, maybe not a lot, but you have to start some sort of a fight. Yeah. And after that, I didn't play that perfectly from there on. We were in the second time control. I kind of got quite low on time, like 5 minutes, 5-6 minutes. I started this counterplay on the queen side with like rook b8 and so on. I played a5, b4. And things became quite complicated, and I was very happy that, okay, at least, okay, I'm down on time. Like, everything in my position is maybe not optimal. Still fighting for my life, but at least it's much more, it's much more double-edged.
Yeah. Yeah, it's opened up, and suddenly one mistake, actually, as it turned out, right?
Yeah.
He, once the position became equal, like, you immediately got a winning position, right? As soon as things opened up, and then he missed this knight fork. I assume at least that's what he missed.
I believe so, yeah.
And then he had this miracle at the end. But I mean, how would you find this unless you know that it's there? Like, it's just such a random chance that white got.
Yeah, this is also another issue with chess, is that, like, when the tide changes, to keep your cool is quite difficult. Like, when the... For example, he was pressing throughout the whole game. I had no active moves. Then all of a sudden, everything had become much, much better for black. Now, to keep his calm and, like, make sure that, okay, there's no tricks and so on, like, he played Bishop 6-7 quite quickly, and then all of a sudden I was winning, and after you go from winning to losing, it's very, your instinct is just play a couple moves and just, okay, if it's a draw, I make a draw, otherwise, okay, if I lose, I'm just going home now.
Yeah, you lose your sense of where you are in the game. It's like, the shift is too
momentum
drastic.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you handle that well, like, trend shifts during the game? Because that's a huge part, I think, of chess, is being able to sense when the trend is changing, when suddenly you're the aggressor, or when you suddenly have a chance to win the game. Do you feel like that's one of your strengths, that you can feel like the momentum of the game well?
Yeah, I think it's one of the areas I need to work on. Like, this one of my games against Hans, I think round four, mm-hmm. I was better off the opening. I had a good position. Then all of a sudden, I didn't really have too much of a plan. And okay, at that point, I should have realized that, okay, this game is not going in my favor. I should just bail out, make a draw.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was I kept queens on the board. Then within a couple moves, I offered a queen trade. Like, he offered a queen trade, I said no. Then within two moves, I realized, okay, my position is not going well. And I offered a queen trade. And after that, I made some terrible moves and I managed to lose the game. It was this momentum change I still have issues with.
Yeah, and I remember your guys' game. When the momentum shifted a little bit, obviously it was a very bad position for you, Abhimanyu, out of the opening, out of the middle game, but then that queen b4 came. And even when we had the interview afterwards, you were concerned that you might have lost your advantage along the way. How did you deal with that?
Well, I wasn't sure how much of the advantage I lost, but I knew that I went from, like, basically the game should be over if I just make a few more accurate moves. And then, yeah, the knight c4 come, my queen is trapped, and suddenly I have to start to calculate again when I didn't really have to. But that game was interesting in terms of trend shifts, for sure. Luckily, I didn't, like, ever spoil it objectively. Yeah. But yeah, it was, I could feel that you sensed that this is, like, because actually you were about to make, after queen b4, you were about to play rook d7. And I was thinking, oh, thank God.
Thank God, I've escaped.
And then you noticed at that moment that knight c4 was a possibility, right? And then
obviously
you quickly played it after you noticed it.
Yeah, but being able to keep your calm in that moment, like, it's very simple. You just make, like, one wrong move, I get a lot of more counterplay. But of course, it feels nice when you're the defender. You start lashing out. Okay, it's like your position finally becomes better. But okay, you never really let me have another chance in that game.
But you still feel at least you're getting some practical chances.
Yes.
Maybe not objective chances, but practical chances you definitely get. And against a lot of players, you would have been able to turn things around in that game, for sure.
Yeah, it's nice. Like, you've been defending the whole game. Okay, you're, like, completely dead lost. Then all of a sudden, your pieces start going forward. His pieces start retreating. And okay, like, maybe something might work.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this is the thing with the top of the top. They don't give you second chances.
Yeah, absolutely. No. What else should we be talking about? Burnout. That's actually a thing I want to talk about with you, because at some point you did encounter a roadblock in terms of your rating ascension, and this seems to have been a very important thing for you. You chased the expert record, you chased the grandmaster record, now you're chasing the 2700 record. But what happens when you have those roadblocks in your path? When, let's not you're not losing a lot of rating, but you're not also gaining a lot of rating. Things seem to be a bit stale in your ascension.
Yeah, this happened at the range of around 2550 for close to a year.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was, okay, I knew that I will go up.
Right.
Like, if I keep learning new things, my strength will increase.
Mm-hmm.
If I keep playing more games, I keep improving my openings. If I keep improving my play in general, then okay, so something has to work. Like, this number is an indication of my strength.
But did you feel any psychological burnout at that point? Hey, I don't want to look at chess anymore. I don't want to play tournaments. I want to take a break. Did that ever come to your mind?
I think it's kind of the opposite when I was stuck. Like, I wanted to break this as quickly as possible. That okay, let's move to the next level and then let's see what happens there. Like, around that time, I did this, I think this was 2-3 months ago, I did this Michael Adams book, Think Like a Super Grandmaster. I was setting each and every position on the board, and with the clock, however time he was taking, if he was taking 5 minutes on the position, I'll put 5 minutes on the clock, and I was doing that. I think in that book, I got, 26-30, they have this kind of, test, 40 positions, and after that, they give you a FIDE estimated rating. My FIDE estimated rating came out to be, 26-30. And okay, at that point, I knew that, okay,
That gave you a confidence boost.
I'm very underrated. I just need to keep improving, keep playing. And okay, if I play to my strength, then I should be going up quite quickly soon.
That's a good strategy, I have to say. Always find tools to try to break that mental barriers. I like it. And we were discussing, I was discussing with your dad during Tata Steel, and we were discussing this type of burnout situation and how to get over it. And I'm glad that you managed to do so. This year. Right now you're at 2630, close to 2630, as you were mentioning. That's your expected, let's say, rating based on that book. What's next is 2700. You have 13 months to go. Who's helping you right now break those barriers? Who are your coaches? You don't have to give us names if you don't want to, but
yeah.
Tell us a bit about those important tools and helpers in your life.
Yeah, unfortunately, I would prefer not to disclose their names. I'm working with a couple different coaches, and okay, I think for the privacy of them, I'd rather not give the names out.
So you have coaches for different aspects of the game, the opening, the middle game. Can you give us at least some ideas in that regard?
Sure.
Okay, there's one opening coach, and then there is a middle game. There's a specific type of middle game coach. Like, how do you?
Sure, because the thing with different players is that not everyone is strong at everything. And I mean, nowadays this is another thing that you need to be universal nowadays. Like, you cannot, in the olden days, okay, you can say maybe I'm a positional player, but nowadays, okay, with openings being very, very analyzed, you need to be able to come up with new ideas, and these new ideas lead to a variety of different positions. And based on that, nowadays you need to be universal. And but the thing is, okay, of course, every player has their own strength and weakness. And yeah, I have some coaches for middle game, some coaches for calculation, some coaches for opening, and so on.
Did you have that growing up?
I had something not quite like that, but I would work sometimes with players for a specific opening. Like, I worked with Razuvayev on the Catalan before he passed away, sadly. I worked with Belyavsky as well. Also, he was an expert on the Catalan, so we were working on this. Things I feel are a bit different now because, the opening tools are such that everyone can be a specialist in any opening, potentially. It's much easier to break through compared to in the old days when I was not very old days. I'm not that old, but definitely the information age has progressed massively.
It's kind of open source.
Yeah, nowadays. Fast fashion. Like, there's many cases that, okay, some person has played some idea, and within 6 hours you look at another term and another person plays the same idea. I think in my game against Wesley, he mentioned that he saw this game between Carlsen and Keimer, and he used that idea in our game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few days later.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly this information is being passed on and how anyone can prepare basically any opening in a couple of days.
So are you following chess games constantly? Are you looking at all chess events and all the games that are being played as much as you can?
Yeah, another thing with these events is, other than opening ideas and so on, another thing that I do is I use them for calculation. So the same way I analyze my own games, I do for their games. So okay, so my dad will look at some of these top events. He'll find some positions where these top players went wrong, and I'll put them over the board and I'll try to solve them myself.
So you're not looking at an engine. You're trying to really immerse yourself in the games and trying to figure them out with your own head before you look at and try to figure out if you found all the details of the game where you analyzed properly. Okay, that's very interesting. That's, I don't think many people are doing that.
No,
I really think that's a very rare training process.
It's a quality that you need to have, right? In personality as well, because not a lot of people can do that, can sit down.
It's
like
difficult.
That.
It's definitely difficult.
For me, that was one of the most difficult things, just because I was restless in not being able to sit down and focus for so long. So that's a quality that definitely will help throughout your career.
I think it really helps to have a second person because, okay, doing all these things by yourself, like if you look at a top game, to see where they made a mistake, the chances are you'll look at the engine line too. But if you have another person doing that for you, that helps a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's definitely to be able to share that labor a bit so you can get some guidance so you don't have to take all the weight of it yourself is very helpful.
And speaking of watching games, I've heard there was this process that Kramnik, and maybe this is nonsense, but my understanding, there was this play chess database being updated every single day with a bunch of games that were played that day. And Kramnik was just going through every single one of those games very quickly, like not trying to think about the position, about the opening, just going through the moves and maybe just visually try to assimilate that. I don't know. Is that something that you do? Is that something that you do at all? Assimilate those patterns by just watching a bunch of games?
Yeah, usually I take a much slower approach, I try to delve very deep into the game. Like just seeing the game is not enough for me.
Yeah.
I have to say I'm a bit more superficial in my approach. I when I was younger, I was definitely applying myself similarly to how you mentioned that you train, working over the board. But that was also because the tools were not quite there as much. Yeah. So it was also, I don't know if I would have been able to do so if I had an engine at the ready all the time. But definitely these days it's more like just skimming over things, just trying to see what's going on. So in this tournament you won 4 games, right?
5.
5 games.
Yes,
5 games. Oh my god.
To him. He lost 3, he won 5 and only 3 draws.
Cuz I remember, okay, so you beat 2 Sams. I beat Hans. You lost to Hans, but you beat Ray and you beat Levon
and Tank.
And you beat Andrew. Oh, 5 games. That's enormous. So it really feels like you had a very fearless approach. Like in a tournament like this, you basically, more than half your results were decisive, much more than half your results. That's quite remarkable. Is that just like your style or is that circumstance or was that also your approach to the tournament?
I think with these kind of tournaments, the second you start playing for draw against like these top players, okay, you're going to get mauled left and right. Mm. Like you cannot try to play very solid and so on. You have to play okay, maybe other players can, but I cannot. Like, I just wanted to have a fight every game because the second things get complicated, it's a 3-result game. I also know that, okay, I've worked on my calculation in these kind of things a lot, that, okay, things will not go... I'm not that much worse than these guys in these areas, so let's go there, let's have a fight. If I lose, I lose. Okay, next game.
I feel that the amount of training that you put in gives you a great deal of confidence going into this type of wars against the best chess players on the planet.
Definitely.
And this is probably something that is extremely important if you are a aspiring player to do. Get your down, excuse my language, get your butt down in that training chair and just like try to figure things out. Try to give yourself those tools to go into this battle and be able to compete.
What about some of the players who are a bit older than you? Like, let's say, players who have already broken through to the top level, like, let's say, Gukesh or Abdusattarov or Pragnanta. Do you feel like you are, you can use them as inspiration, or do you feel like they're the target? So, like, in a few years, you're going to be at their level and you don't want to look to them for inspiration because they're your rivals. How do you feel about that?
It's both ways. These guys have... they're kind of showing that it's possible it's this new generation to break through to the top level. It's not like it's totally not, it's not just the older generation. Okay, not too old, but yeah, not the...
Why are you looking at me when you're saying older generation? I feel so old.
He's older than I am, so that's okay.
Oh, I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest one here.
Oh. So they're an inspiration in the sense that, okay, they can, that they're showing that it's all possible, that they can compete against Carlsen and all these other top players.
Okay.
And yeah, I want to be there as well. So I try to, I think at this age, I think I'm the, like, the, my graph is like better than most of the other players.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you talked about this, having a bunch of coaches traveling to tournaments, and you're notorious for that when you were trying to get from IM to GM and breaking those records. This was a very difficult period in the world of chess because this was at the beginning of COVID, 2020, 2021. Yet you traveled to Europe and you played a lot of chess. That's not cheap. You need sponsorships for that. You need to invest. You've invested and your dad has invested a lot into your progress. Tell us a bit about that. Tell us a bit about sponsorship opportunities for you. How do you see that progress in your career?
Sure. So after I became the youngest international master in the world, I had like 22 months. I was like very sure I was going to break this. Okay, 100 points, 3 norms. Okay, this will be quite nice. It won't be too bad. Then all of a sudden, the world just comes to a stop. Like 8 months, no tournaments.
Right.
Like I was sitting at home. I used this time to improve my chess understanding. I read a lot of books. I think I did Dvoretsky during this time and so on. And yeah, that helped. But okay, there still weren't many tournaments. I think I remember once every 2-3 months, there used to be a 10-hour long car drive to Charlotte for one norm event. We used to spend like 2-3 hours sanitizing the room. Things were terrible back then. It was very scary. Then finally, there were some tournaments that opened up in Europe. I think Hungary was basically one of the only places in the world where you could play these events. So we decided to take all the precautions, double mask, everything, face shield. I have photos in like World Cup wearing a face shield. So there were many, we took many precautions and we decided to go with the one-way ticket to Europe. And there, okay, I played like 77 games in like 90 days or something.
That's costly. Scary. Traveling all around Europe, paying your coaches as well, that's very costly. Do you have any sponsors? How is that going for you?
Yeah, unfortunately, as of now, despite breaking all national and international records, I have no sponsors. For a brief period, Chessable was sponsoring me, but ever since the merger with chess.com, okay, nothing. Everything has been shut down.
Do you feel like that's a chess problem, that just chess is struggling to find sponsorships, or is there something else behind it? Is it perhaps something to do with United States chess, or do you think it's better in other countries, or how do you see that?
I think, yeah, US is like one of the best countries financially, but the issue is in terms of visibility towards chess, here it's not so high. Here, like, to become top chess players, of course. Here, chess is used as a tool to get into Ivy League colleges and so on. It's as opposed, if you look as into India, you have all these amazing young talents and everyone has been like fully funded for the last couple of years. I think I heard of some story that there was this 16-year-old person who became grandmaster, I'm not entirely sure about the age, but they became grandmaster and the state government asked him, what do you want to do with chess? He said, I want to become super grandmaster. And they asked him, how much money do you need? He gave some number like $200,000 and they gave him $250,000. Here, things are not like that. Here, people, they don't care too much.
Yeah, and that seems like more of a difference. In India, you have government support, a lot of that, right? A lot of the oil companies as well. But at the same time, having Vishy Anand as one of, and this is funny because Hikaru keeps mentioning Vishy as the Jesus and disciples. His disciples, right? All these Indian kids that are 2,700 and plus. We don't have that necessarily, the government support in the United States. We don't have that culture. It's almost like a cultural difference. Do you think that could change in any way?
yeah, that could potentially change in the future now that chess is receiving more and more exposure throughout, like, nowadays, like, this chess boom is going on. Like, I think since Queen's Gambit, the popularity has been rising of this game.
Sure, yeah.
And, yeah, maybe things will get better in the future. Mm-hmm. Another thing is that, okay, like, here, with chess, another thing is unless you reach the top of the top, it's very difficult to make a living of this game. And now here, like, with five times less effort, you can get into Ivy League college, you can make very good money, and, okay, you can live a very, very simple life. But the issue is, okay, with chess, you need to work much harder and you need to get to a much, much higher level. So that's probably another reason why it's not...
Yeah, this is something definitely that I've noticed with young talents in the United States compared to, for example, India especially, is that you have very talented players in the United States, but they generally, after college, tend to pursue other career paths because they're usually more...
More stable.
Stable or financially rewarding, and chess is a bit more of a gamble very often, yeah. And definitely that it feels also like a cultural thing somewhat because, as you mentioned, the government support, but also in the United States, it's very much like company sponsorships. That's where corporate support that we're looking for chess tournaments or sometimes private donors, but the government doesn't get involved in that whatsoever. So that's a big difference with India. And like Indian chess players, they have so much, as you mentioned, so much support. Not just the top players, who of course get enormous support, but also the young grandmasters, the rising talents, they're also getting huge support. So that's very, seems like a cultural difference in some ways as well.
I think so, yeah. And probably it's just about when we manage to get chess as a game involved in ESPN, involved in this like big networks, put it on TV, get a lot of eyes on it. I think that's when we're going to start seeing this trickle down into the corporate sponsorship when it comes to players, individual players as well.
Do you think that will take a long time? Because I feel like
it's been a process for a while, right?
No, definitely it's a long process, but also a lot of that money will end up in the biggest, where all the eyeballs will get, the players who will get all the views.
Yes.
And then the other approach is to invest in the players who have a bright future, but they don't have they're not famous at the moment, but someday they will be, because that's more of a long-term thing. And I don't know if companies go for that, or rather they go for, okay, let's invite Hikaru and Nakamura. Yep. Sorry, Hikaru and Magnus.
Hikaru and Nakamura.
Hikaru and Magnus for a match, and that's what's obviously going to get most people, eyes on the event. So yeah, that's a question as well.
And that's something that you've been trying to do as well. I'm sure your dad probably manages you in some regard, and you've been posting on social media as well. Do you see that aspect of, let's say, professional sports, the social media presence, having that type of reach, having that type of platform? Do you feel that is important towards your success in your career?
Yeah, I'm going to be totally honest about this. I don't use any of my social media accounts. It's all managed by my parents, because all this is very...
Of course, you're 14. Come on.
Of course. Yeah, of course. It's a very dark world out there.
As it should be, yeah.
And okay, like I don't... I have to... My job is to play chess, and okay, that they can deal with these kind of things. They can inquire with companies about sponsorships and so on. It's not my job.
Absolutely, no. And speaking of social media, we always see this type of drama springing around, and one of them included you as well. When you became a grandmaster, there was this tweet by Jan Nepomniachtchi basically questioning the whole process of getting and achieving norms. How did that impact you?
Yeah, I'd like to start this off by saying I respect Jan as a player. He's like, he's one of the best players in the world. But it was also a bit strange. Like, okay, he should have brought these things up a long time ago. Like, these things could have been changed like 17 years ago when he became Grandmaster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, now he's bringing up after someone broke the record. And okay, like, this 12-year-old kid is... And the issue is after he made that tweet, every single article written about me quoted that as if I did something wrong. But I just played according to the rules.
Yeah. Did you feel it took some shine away from your achievement?
Yeah, yeah. I was a bit disappointed to see this, especially as all the other top players were very
supportive.
Very supportive of it.
I feel like this is also, like, it very often happens that there's this question about tournaments. And also, like, I had this not to the extent that you had it, that it was public, but I also made all my norms in tournaments in Budapest. Yeah, there's always some questions about events. From my experience, they were completely legitimate events. That there was nothing weird that happened. Of course, there are some events in chess that are that some you know exchanging goes on or something something weird happens. But it always is the case that the statement is made later on. Like you can become a GM at whatever age, but the question is, of course, do you continue those results? And so we have this with some players that it's questioned, but then they either prove that they are going to someday be a top player or they don't progress. So it's not really a question, I feel, about the events. It's about what happens after that.
Yeah. And you've proved through and throughout that your progress continues. Even after that, you are definitely GM level and above after that. Your ascent has been remarkable, I have to say. What's the next step in terms of your training? What do you need to not necessarily change, but add to your game in order to get 2700?
Yeah, as of now, I have a feeling I still need to work on all my areas. Like, okay, from here to 2700, it's like it may just seem like 80 points, not a big deal. Like, I just gained like 20 points, maybe okay, another four tournaments, but okay, realistically, I know it's not going to be this easy.
Absolutely.
I think like 2650 to 2700 is going to be very difficult, and it'll require a lot of different things.
That's a shark tank right there, 2650 to 2700.
Definitely. There's so many players who are like top of the top even. Like, I think, for example, Morozevich was like 2790 at some point, right? Now he's like 2650. Like, if you play against these people, like, it's
crazy,
very scary.
Or the younger crowd is so... I mean, we saw today that Magnus lost to a player who's 26-16, who played an immaculate game, right?
Kartikeyan, yeah.
Yeah, Kartikeyan. And we see that players of this level are really able to get scalps against the strongest. And also their openings are good at, like, the competition is pretty immense. Which is also why I was, like, so impressed with your five wins here, because it's tough to get wins. We saw a lot of players struggling, like Wesley, Lanier. They pick up a win here and there, but to get five wins, it takes a lot of either fight or a lot of skill. So it's a tough... I have to say, my days getting into the level that you're aiming for, they were a lot easier. You're in the, yeah, as you said, the shark tank. It's a tough time, but yeah, for sure, your progress has been... just straight up.
Absolutely. And
thank you.
During our last interview, I think you mentioned something about the differences in paths that you can take. You can start playing this type of very strong closed events, or you can try to gain those rating points in open tournament events. And from my understanding, you're trying to achieve that through closed, very strong, very high quality level players events. Why is that? Why is that the path? And also, this feels very strategic from you. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it all started from when I was getting my IM norms. The whole purpose of this is it'll be easier for me later on. Okay, maybe like 25 to 2600 was much slower, but now that I'm kind of accustomed to this level of play, now, okay, I don't need to change too many things to get to the next level. I'm already used to the playing field.
Got it. No, I like it.
Do you feel like chess is... Sorry, I didn't mean to...
No, you've actually won a lot of your rating points between 26 and 2700 in open tournaments, right?
Yeah, it was a lot of open tournaments, I have to say.
You were playing 100 games per year, from open to open.
But there was a mix. But I think the chess scene has also shifted a little bit compared to... I mean, especially because we've seen, the pandemic, as you said, that had a huge impact on the chess world. And also when we had... in 2008, the economic crisis, the collapse of that also had a huge impact. Like, that changed a lot. Tournaments in Spain, for example, I used to play in Spain all the time. A lot of those events just disappeared, like in one year, basically. Just economic situation was. I was going to ask you something, but now I'm thinking.
I threw you off.
Yes, I had a question.
With the open tournaments. Oh man.
Well, actually, I remember. So. Do you feel like chess is definitely or almost definitely going to be your life path? Or do you feel like there's also some, you're not 100% sure about if there, maybe you'll go in some other direction as well? Or do you feel firmly focused in this goal?
Well, we'll see how things go from here. I'm currently, I'm in ninth grade. I still have another like 3-4 years before I have to formally decide which path I'm taking. But as of now, I'm keeping both options open.
And that's actually something that I just realized as you were mentioning that you're also going to school. You also have that potential option. You also have those responsibilities that come going to school. For whatever reason, in my mind, school was not even a thing going on in your life.
Well, it's not as big of a thing as chess. I spend most of my time on chess every day. The thing with my school is that I go to an online school. It's Crimson Global Academy. They are very flexible in terms of timings and such. For example, I had to come to this tournament. I wrote a mail to my teachers that I won't be able to attend these many classes, and now I'll go back, I'll finish the work, and everything will be back to normal. And the fact that they have this flexibility is very, very good for me.
Mm-hmm. So you still keep that in the back of your mind, because I know a lot of players, your capabilities and your age, they usually go the homeschooling approach, or they just quit school altogether. I think Magnus did that. I stopped. Well.
I stopped going to school earlier than, younger than you are now. So I was already at 12. I was not 100% committed, but definitely moving along that path.
Yeah.
A lot of players in, we were talking to Carissa, for example, a lot of players in the women's event, they're also going to school at the same time. And they were mentioning the difficulty in, like Jennifer also mentioning the difficulty in balancing schoolwork and chess work, because they're both so intensive, especially during a tournament. You have to prepare for your games, and then you also have like this other thing to think about. I can only imagine the difficulty in balancing that.
Yeah, it was quite funny. I was playing in Sharjah, Sharjah, and after like two rounds, I had to appear for one of my exams. Like on the third day, I had to take a bye. Like I lost 0 out of 2 and I had to take a bye. And I think this is also kind of about bouncing back. That day I had to appear for my exams, things went relatively fine. And from there I actually managed to have a decent tournament. Like I got 4 out of 8 and I got my points back and I gained some points. It was a nice event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. And going back a few notches, we discussed about the importance of idols, the importance of people to look up to. We were talking about Vichy and all his disciples. You also worked with a legend, Garry Kasparov, the Kasparov Chess Foundation. They helped you, supported you throughout your career. How important were those training sessions, seeing Garry in his element, seeing his passion, his dedication, his burning fire still, even after he retired? How important was that for you?
It's amazing, frankly. For example, I think this was quite recent, last year or so. There was every 6 months we have this session. This time it was in St. Louis. So there was a TV in the right corner. It had some queen knight ending. There were some videos of St. Louis Chess Club playing on repeat, and there was this queen knight ending. And then Garry looked at the position and we were going through, we were showing our games and so on, but you could tell for next hour or so, he was very tense. He was he was very concentrated on the puzzle. And finally he solved the puzzle. It was amazing to see how much focus he put into that puzzle.
A tension release, at that moment when you finally find the right solution.
Is chess also playing constantly in your head as well? Is it something that whatever you're doing, it's always in the back of your mind?
Yeah, definitely. Especially during a tournament, but even otherwise, it's always something that's going on. It's as of now, it's basically my life, but.
Absolutely. And there's also, it almost feels that there's not necessarily an added pressure, but almost something in the back of your mind when you're being chosen by this type of institutions. Kasparov Chess Foundation, they've supported the best of the best throughout the years. You're part of that mix. Now there's an added responsibility almost. Do you feel that gives you more motivation? Do you feel any additional stress on your shoulders? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's more motivation that, you're working with the best of the best, and let's play to the best of the best so we can learn even more. Yeah. It's okay if you don't play to your best. Okay, it's you can't learn too much from that.
Yeah, yeah, I like it. I like it. Well, Abi, I think we've covered so much ground at such a young age, so much maturity coming from you. Fabi, do you want to add anything? Or
no, I just want to say it was a pleasure to talk to you today. And
same.
Also,
thank
I look
you.
Forward to our games in the future. I'm sure that we'll be playing each other quite a bit in the coming years, so that'll be exciting, and I look forward to it.
Abi, anything you would like to add? Any thanks to your supporters?
Sure.
Anywhere they can find you? Tell us.
Sure, I'd like to thank everyone who supported me in this journey, from my friends to my family, to the people who watch my games online. Thank you, everyone, for everything. Your support means everything to me.
Awesome. Well, cheers, guys. See you in the next video.